AM FM 24/7 radio network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. It is Tuesday, August 6th, and we've got a great show for you today. Really appreciate you being with us. First up today, we have New York Times best-selling author Grant Blackwood. You've probably read some of his books. Very successful. We're going to talk about his career and how to emulate it. And then our favorite Canadian entrepreneur, Wayne Elliott, is with us again to talk more about his career. We are writing a book together, and so this is part of that. We're going to give you a peek behind the curtain, but we need to go ahead and get started. Please welcome Grant Blackwood to the show. He is a New York Times best-selling number one author. His hero is the Briggs Tanner series, and he has had incredible success there. He is also co-written with some of the greats of all time. He co-wrote a book with Tom Clancy, I think, and then also with my personal favorite, Clive Cussler. He has a new book out right now that I'm excited to talk about that is co-written with Steve Barry. All you loyal listeners know that Steve has been on the show five or six times before. He's one of our favorite repeat guests. But today we are excited to welcome Grant Blackwood to the show. Grant, welcome. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure, and thank you for your service in the Navy, right?
Right.
I had to think to figure out which branch you were in.
You got it right.
Tell us about Briggs Tanner.
Well, Briggs Tanner was, you know, my first character, my first baby. I started writing about Tanner in July of 87, which is the first year I started writing. So 37 years ago to this month, Tanner popped in my head, and that became three books in a series, End of Enemies. He's an interesting guy. He has a really diverse background, and he knows how to get in trouble, which he often does, and he knows how to get out of trouble, and had a lot of fun. He's on an extended hiatus right now, and I don't know if he'll be back, but we'll see.
Who is he closest to in terms of the other superhero characters that we all love?
Oh, you know, I would say he's more of a Captain America, simply because all he's got is you know, Captain America brings enhanced strength and abilities to the table, and that's all that Tanner brings to the table in a lesser degree, but all he's got is what he's been trained to do and his physicality and his mind. So that's, and he's got a certain moral compass as Captain America does too.
All right. But here today, we're going to talk more about Luke Daniels. I have talked about Luke before with Steve. Your newest book is Red Star Falling, a Luke Daniels novel. I think this is book two of the series so far. How do you write two different superheroes? How is Luke different? Don't you get them confused sometimes?
You know, not really. Briggs Tanner was a long, long time ago, and we started, you know, Luke started with Steve in the Lincoln Myth. I think that's where Luke first made his appearance as a fledgling Magellan billet operative. And the stories we tell, the first book was Ninth Man, and then this is Red Star Falling. This is Luke, who is doing things when he's not with Magellan Billet. And he's growing over time, but he had a rough start when he first appeared in with Cotton Malone.
And what's this book about? What happens in the latest?
So, you know, in The Ninth Man, we tackled the Kennedy assassination in a notional view of how that might have played out and what it would take in a fictional world to solve that. But when we turn to Red Star Falling, Steve and I had both heard of a legend about a nuclear weapons platform the Soviets put up in space during the Cold War. And it was supposed to be a first strike weapon that was essentially unstoppable. And whether that's true or not, we don't know. Somebody probably knows. We don't. And we just started playing the what if game. What if this happened? What if that happened? And we also worked into it something Steve has always been attracted to, and that is the Lost Library of Ivan the Terrible. And so we weave the story together, and Luke gets himself dragged into this because he's on a rescue mission to kind of save an old friend in a mission that went wrong, and he's back to save him, but he gets mixed up in all of it.
Sounds great. I love it. Sounds like it would make a great movie. I also love The Ninth Man, and something funny happened when I was interviewing Steve about The Ninth Man. That's the Kennedy assassination book, right?
Yes.
I 100% believe the thesis of your book, what you do in The Ninth Man. As a matter of fact, okay. I think that's the real solution. I really believe that is what happened. And I was sort of espousing this. And then I discovered, I was like, well, Steve, what happens in the book? And then he tells me basically the same thing. And I said, oh, we're talking about the same thing here. I maybe have gave away too much in that interview. But I think that's really what happened with Kennedy. What about you?
It's very, very plausible. It's a lot more plausible than I thought it was when I got done reading the book we based it on. And once I kind of went through how that scenario might look in Dealey Plaza, and how it might play out and kind of mixing fiction with facts, it became even more plausible over time. But I'm kind of one of those people that I think we'll never actually know. We can only get as close as probably.
Right. Well, I think your story and the book that it was based on, can we tell people what that book is?
That book is Mortal Error.
Right. I forget. That's one of the Kennedy assassination study books.
Right. And it was by a gentleman who did a lot of research into ballistics, and he reached this conclusion at the end.
Right. And I think ballistics are the key because, you know, you can tell things from wounds and certain ballistic evidence. And I think you nailed it. And what's so weird, Grant, is to think about what's going on now with the Trump attempt and all of the people saying that there's a conspiracy there and how the Secret Service may be failing there. Do you see any parallels between those two stories?
Well, I do and I don't. And then I know that these kinds of investigations, especially in modern times, take longer than people would like them to take. I don't necessarily see that as a conspiracy or you know, dereliction of duty. There's just so many T's to cross and I's to dot in this sort of thing. So I'm happy at this point to wait to see what the FBI comes up with.
Right. All you listeners who can't figure out what we're talking about, I'm not going to tell you what I think the Kennedy thing is, because I don't want to ruin Steve and Grant's book any more than I already have. But you should read The Ninth Man if you're a Kennedy person, because it is, I think, they finally nailed it after, 50 or 60 years now. We finally have it figured out. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
We learned a lot of things that we didn't realize about the event itself, but also the aftermath, the Warren Commission report, and things that were surprisingly overlooked. I place no malicious behavior behind that, but just surprising things that did get overlooked.
Yes. How do you work with another great? You've worked with Steve Barry, of course, and Tom Clancy, maybe the greatest in the genre of all time. Clive Cussler, my personal favorite. How do you work with someone like that? How do you put your ego aside and team up and have good productivity and not get, bogged down in who's more famous and who sold more pages?
Well, I also work with Jim Rollins. I did two great books with Jim Rollins, who has a stellar reputation all on his own. But, for me as a co-author going in, everyone I've worked with has been a bigger name than I am. And that's just truth. So I need to one, put my ego aside. And primarily it's about making sure that I create a product that fits into that author's fiction universe. And so now that I have that purpose in mind, everything gets a lot easier. And especially with Steve, we have very similar sensibilities about what a thriller is. And we believe that a thriller's primary purpose is to entertain the reader. And so we always have that in our mind. Is a reader going to find this entertaining? And we have similar sensibilities about how to tell an entertaining story. And we worked out early on what role I would play. And that's primarily as we flesh out the book a little bit. And once we're happy with the broad strokes, he turns me loose and I write the first draft. And then I send that to him. And he spends about a month putting his distinct kind of Steve Barry stamp on it for his audience.
Sounds like a good process. What's your personal writing process? Are you locked in a quiet room, music on, a long yellow legal pad directly into the computer, dictation? What makes it work for you, Grant?
What makes it work for me is one, I got to get out of my head and just sit down. It sounds like an oxymoron, but I have to stop thinking and just sit down. My office is very quiet. It's kind of dimly lit except for some strategic lighting. I don't listen to music, and I don't have a window I look out. I just sit and I go until I hit my quota.
What does that mean? What do you mean, your quota? Are you force yourself to do 2,000 words a day? Or what does that mean?
Whatever it is, I mean, whatever the deadline is, whatever the pub date is, I know that how many days I need to write and how much I need to, you know, produce each day to hit that deadline. I don't always hit it perfectly, and I sometimes get behind. But generally, if I'm on a track of X number of words a day, I know I'll get to where I need to be when I'm done.
Do you have days where you're just not there? Mentally, the pen isn't working?
Sometimes, yes, but more often not, because I'm overly practical. I'm not a big believer in the muse has to visit you. I'm a believer in you simply tell you the muse is going to sit down beside you, and that's the way it is, and let's get it done. And so often when I feel stuck or I don't want to do it, as long as I can sit down and start hitting the keys, eventually something comes.
You ever just walk away and say, not now?
For a few minutes, and then I'll come back. And if I hit, you know, five or six not now times, I might take a longer break. It takes me a lot of frustration before I just throw out my hands, though.
So let's talk about Clive for just a second. For those of you who don't know, Clive Cussler, thriller writer, his character was Brad Pitt, whose distinction was that he was a famous Marine researcher and marine rescue person, worked with a secret organization. I don't know if it's a secret organization, but a maritime organization called NUMA that would go around, and he did things like raise the Titanic, and they made a movie about that didn't do so well. I love Clive. I really do, Grant, but every one of his books was the exact same. And my dad and I used to joke, we'd read 50 pages and go, I've read this before. But it was so formulaic. You always knew that Brad Pitt was going to save someone in chapter two who was in the middle of the Arctic, strangely. And lo and behold, Brad Pitt was there too, you know?
Right.
Awfully formulaic. It felt like AI was writing it there at the end. Still my favorite. What are your thoughts on this? It seems like some of these thrillers are becoming too AI-ish.
AI is, I have a big concern about AI, and we can talk about that later. But, you know, Clive is very tuned in to what his audience loved. People criticize the band U2 that all their songs sound the same. And I don't think that's a matter of a lack of creativity. I think that's a matter of knowing what your audience wants and giving it to them. Clive was a hugely creative guy, but he also was keenly aware that he's writing books for people to enjoy. In fact, he said once that I'm an entertainer. I just happen to do it on paper. So I think that explains a lot about where he went. He just knew what his readers loved. And, you know, I was one of those readers that loved his work. In fact, you know, I was reading one of his books when I decided I wanted to do this for a living. So he's had a huge impact on my life.
So if we were to take one of those books and outline it and then copy it, is this a good formula to write our first book? Give us some advice on getting our first book out.
Well, first things first is this is neglected. I'm shocked at how much this is neglected. Most successful authors are writing what they love to read. The vast majority are. And step two is make sure you just devour your genre. You have to know everything and everyone about it. And so you're immersed in it. So it's your world. And so when you start writing a book, you have this background of knowledge that says, you know, this has worked and this hasn't. And so you have that kind of living library to tap into. And once you've got that, you've got your purpose, you've got your genre, you know what works and what doesn't, then you just have to dive in and start. And I have tools and techniques that I use, but it's really about knowing your purpose, knowing what you're about, what kind of book you want to write, and be persistent.
What do you mean, what kind of book you want to write? There's nothing wrong with writing an airplane book and accept it and embrace it? Is that what you mean?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah. If you love writing, you know, just beach reads, romance, that's fine. If that's your passion, you're most likely to be successful if you're writing the kind of genre you love to read.
All right.
There is some people say that, you know, genre fiction really doesn't have any value. You get that from more elite circles. And I happen to feel that escapism and enjoyment, it has great value. And I think when you look at the genre fiction that sells, I think that bears out my point.
All right, Grant, I heard you were willing and able to play our little game, the Quick 10.
Yes.
I am required by, you're in Colorado, right?
I am.
I am required by state law to ask, are you currently sober?
I am currently sober.
You don't have to be. You can change that. Would you like to take a break and come back not sober?
Well, no, I don't drink at all, so okay. I could take a break. Nothing will change, though.
All right. Would you like to accept the standard wager? The standard wager.
Which is what?
The bet that everyone else has made?
Well, yeah, I'll take
there
it.
You
I'll
go.
Take
Number
it on
one,
space.
Your favorite yeah. creativity yeah. hack.
Favorite creativity hack from just blue sky, no ideas, mind mapping, along with what I call the what if, what then plotting method.
Number two, favorite bootstrapping trick.
There will never be a perfect time to pursue your goals. It won't come. You just have to dive in. And this quote from Arthur Ashe, I think, says it all. And it is, start where you are, use what you have, do what you can.
Number three, name your top passions.
Writing, reading, exercise, being with family, and being in nature.
Number four, the first three steps in starting a business are?
Know your mission, in my case. Know what book you're trying to write. Know what success looks like, meaning the end goal, what you're trying to accomplish, and be persistent. It's going to be a long road, whatever you're pursuing.
Number five, the best way to get your first real customer is?
Give them what they want.
Number six, your dreamiest technology is?
I would like an all-in-one writing application that essentially is a conglomeration of everything I've learned over these past 37 years.
Number seven, best entrepreneurial advice?
Same as above, persist.
Number eight, worst entrepreneurial mistake?
Not doing your homework before you pull the trigger.
Number nine, favorite entrepreneur and why?
Clive Cussler, because that's why I am where I am.
Excellent. Number 10, favorite superhero, Brad Pitt.
For reasons I can't really put my finger on, the Hulk.
All right. While we calculate the score and find out the winner of the wager, Grant, how do we find out more, follow you online, and most importantly, get a copy of Red Star Falling?
You can go to two places. One, my website is grantblackwood.com, and Steve Barry is found at steveberry.org.
Fantastic. And the book is 5-star rated on that Amazon place. I'm just kind of blowing time here until someone gives my team gives it. Oh, Grant, I've just been handed your score. You got a 94, a 94. You have to have a 95 to win. I don't know which one of the judges dinged you. Or something, but maybe it was the AI judge. But Excellent answer.
The AI judge.
To win. So you owe us a Tesla. A Tesla. We play for a Tesla always.
Will you take the Cybertruck?
If I have to. I mean, my God, is that the ugliest thing ever? I don't know what they were thinking. And then it took so long to... What are your thoughts on it? I'm just not impressed with that truck.
Well, one of the top subreddits on Reddit is what's called Cyberstuck. And it's about Cybertrucks going wrong. So the popularity of that subreddit tells you that there are a lot of people that are not fond of it.
Well, you know, the 2 days after it started getting released, there were already pictures of it rusting and things like that. So Elon's had a tough year. So
he has.
Grant Blackwood, thank you so much for being with us. Very interesting, great stuff. Congratulations on the book. And we'd love to have you back.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
We are back. And again, thank you so very much for being with us. I'm excited to welcome back to the show Wayne Elliott. He is our favorite Canadian environmentalist entrepreneur, an amazing career in the ship demo business, which has led to all sorts of incredible recycling efforts, including the first one to figure out commercial recycling for lithium. And we're talking about all sorts of things. Wayne, welcome back. How you doing?
I'm good, Jim. How are you doing?
I am well today. All right. You got some things you want to talk about. Tell us the story and get us set up.
Okay. I thought what I'd mentioned today, we've talked a lot about business and, we've certainly covered a great number of my mistakes and over the past dozen or so shows. But I wanted to raise this for folks to consider. Chances are we all know someone or more than someone who just cannot admit to making a mistake or taking ownership in, as I would call it, ownership in their mistakes. And I've just had it, it isn't the first time it's happened, but it kind of came to a head for a friend of 58 years. And it's funny that I had to think back, Jim. The first time it happened was when we were age 16, and there was some trouble, and it was his fault, and he told my dad it was me. And we had a fight that day, and he moved back to his house. He'd been living with us for the summer. So I've known him all these years since. Now, I must say, he's been an employee of one government agency or another for 50 of those years, or 45 of those years, something like that anyway.
Interesting detail.
Yeah, until we hired him. Now, I haven't had a lot of experience with friends that work for the government. But, of course, my lawyer explained this to me 50 years ago. Pardon me, government people, no matter what division, what part of the government, what government level, federal, provincial, or state, municipal, they, as my lawyer would call it, they live in a box. They're in a box. Notwithstanding common sense or financial prudence or anything like that, there's rules and they cannot step outside that box. The policies, the rules are what they are. And unlike, you know, private industry and the rest of us, we're not in a box. We can, if you're in business and you have a sensible idea, you want to change something, you can do it. But the government employees, they are in this box. It's no judgment against them. It's just the way it is. Well, what I've learned through my former friend is that the way that they can handle getting what they want, doing what they want, is simply lying. Got to go to the doctor. Got to go to the physiotherapist. Got to go to the chiropractor, the dentist, whatever. They want time off, a week off, death in the family. Any excuse is pretty much taken, accepted. And in this fellow's case, That's what he always did, was lie. And it's so easy to tell the truth. It's just so easy to tell the truth. I've always found it easy. You don't have to remember what you said. It's just the truth. Well, I kind of sloughed it off for years when he came to work with us. Little things I would not pay attention, or I would, you know, turn a blind eye. And then, you know, things came to a head, and it went much further than I thought. He had a senior position, and with one of the business units that I was looking after, I just found this out recently as well. He's telling the salesman, don't listen to Wayne. We're not going to sell that in liquid, so don't promote it, don't offer it. Which is really something when they go beyond their boss's instructions and wishes. But it's a real danger sign, Jim, for anyone in business that's going to hire somebody. Pardon me. And of course, sometimes it takes time to know a person's like that, or you have to actually have something happen that you catch. My dad always told me, you can watch a thief, but you can't watch a liar. And that's true. You cannot watch a liar. And my goodness, I was just so upset by this, especially being a friend for almost 60 years. And he just cannot, no matter what it is, admit that he's made a mistake. And it's potentially a very dangerous thing in business. As far as his staff goes, those types of people will often be, you know, anything goes for the staff. Well, you want the day off? Sure, you know, go ahead. I once went into the office of, I believe there was 11 at that time in the main office. And nine were gone one day. And I guess, you know, he had given everybody the permission, whatever their reason was for not being there. But the entitlement can really be something. And private enterprise isn't like that. You know, I've found with government people is that they don't have to be as accountable. Pretty tough to get fired from a government job. It really is. These unions, for example, in the education department here in Canada, it's the richest union in the world, the Ontario Teachers Federation. They own sports teams, meat packing plants. They're very, very wealthy and very strong union. Even when teachers get into trouble for mishandling youth, you know, right down to dating kids that they're teaching. It costs so much for the government to prosecute that they most of it goes unchecked. And
right.
So it's something really to watch for, you know, for my sake. I can't think of other people I've ever hired that spent a career with the government. And maybe that's why I just knew that there's, you know, for example, and this fellow's whole family works for the government in one place or another. And you take, I think they call it Canada Services, and that's where you would go if you need a new passport, a visa, if you're coming into Canada, you want to be a landed immigrant, any of those services. Well, we've had 2 million people in Canada, immigrants, waiting for permission to go to work. Now, Canada is paying for them, putting them up in motels and so forth, paying them. But the Canada Services people are in no rush to pick up the speed at all. And we need the workers in Canada. If the last few years, no matter who you talk to, no matter what business and no matter what job description, everybody needed more people. Well, these you know, these government employees at Canada Services, they're not going to pick up the speed. I don't know whether they ever work overtime or not, but huge lineup makes a big difference to the country. And, you know, they're not accountable when it comes to that. You know, it's like crossing the border, really. If there can be a lineup of a mile, that's not those officers' problems. They're going to take whatever time they feel they need with each person or each vehicle crossing. So I've just found that it's less, you know, they have strong unions, the government workers, and maybe in their defense, when they do good work, I don't know, maybe there's probably no bonuses. There's probably no reward for doing a great job. I don't know that for sure, but I don't think there is. Maybe a chance of promotion. But I'll tell you, it's a very dangerous thing, and especially when there's lying involved and you're not getting the truth. It's pretty tough. It's like, I don't play poker, but I imagine it would be like playing blind poker. You don't get to see your cards, and you've got to decide on what you're going to bet. So I just wanted to bring out that point. And I think a lot of people know someone who just cannot be wrong, cannot make a mistake. I'm not talking about a strong-willed person, or I'm talking about somebody who just cannot take ownership in something they've done that didn't work out. And
Wayne, as a boss, what do you do in that situation? Do you fire them?
Well, I certainly would have in this situation. He doesn't work for me now. He works for one of the family companies, but not for me. But I certainly would have after this last round. And some of the most outrageous things, accidents, for example. It was an accident involving this fellow, not a car accident, but an accident. And he didn't do it on purpose, but still could not admit that he did it. And outrageous, really, to me. It's like having an accident saying, no, I didn't have the accident. And I'm not talking about in a car. But yes, that would be my answer. If it happens again with anybody who's under my charge, actually it has, Jim. It has in another business that I'm the chief ticket and director, and this person could not be wrong, could not be mistaken, could not take direction, even though was dropping the ball on this part of their job. And so instead of accepting constructive criticism from their supervisor, they went on sick leave. And, you know, in this world, it's a pretty easy thing to do. You need a doctor's note and then off you go. And, but once again, a person who just cannot be wrong must be right. So I just wanted to bring that up today because it's something I don't think we often think about. And when a person's in business, you know, you're trying to hire the best person or the best people that you can. And that's really something to watch for. I took to years ago when I was involved in the interview process, asking people at your last job, what's the biggest mistake you made? And, you know, most people are honest and will tell you. If someone can't think of one, you probably have one of those characters on your hands. I mean, who among us hasn't made mistakes, Jim? Really?
Well, I haven't. So.
Well, I sure have. And the more you do, the more a person does.
That it's mind-boggling. I'm just blown away by how I keep making the same mistake again and again, it seems, too, sometimes.
So. Well, I've done that too, Jim, and I always considered myself a very fair person, and I always want to be fair. I was an athlete. I didn't want to play in a game where a referee was biased one way or another. A baseball umpire was biased. Who wants to play in a rigged game? I don't even want to win a game like that, and then much less lose one. But you know, the more a person does, you would expect the more mistakes they've likely made. If you do nothing, if you spent your whole life on the couch watching TV, I guess as long as you didn't end up 600 pounds, you could say, I've never made a mistake. But you haven't done anything either. You haven't done much of anything. So this fairness identity I had, it actually took some self-discovery training for me, self-awareness training, to see that everything has another side to it. Every coin has two sides. And so it comes down to, okay, what is being too fair? I'll give you some examples. I'm thinking of one fella now that worked for the company eight different times, right from a teenager, and always trouble and ended up quitting or getting fired or whatever it was, and we kept taking him back. Now, that fella worked out in the end. It only took 30 years and six or seven or eight tries. So maybe that's too fair. We've done this a lot, taking back people. Some of our work is very hard work. You can't get just everybody to go out when it's 30 below and cut steel, or when it's 90 Fahrenheit and humid to cut steel and in the sun. But we've been too lax. You know, at some point we need to learn that, wait a minute now, the guy had five tries, it didn't work out, so this probably isn't too wise. And, you know, I've done it. Our company's certainly done it. And how often does it work out? I don't know. I don't want to exaggerate, but I'd be surprised if it were 1 out of 10. I really would. In the long run, I mean, that a person changes their ways and grows up, matures, whatever, and stops causing those troubles. But it's so important, the the hiring process, because these days with human rights and such, it's kind of akin to adopting a child. Great responsibilities here in Canada, great responsibilities come with hiring someone. So you'd like to do a good job in the selection process. Of course, then there's the cost of hiring someone, putting them through the training process, which means someone else has been involved with them for a considerable length of time, depending on the job and job title. And then to lose them or have to let them go, you start all over again, and it's just very costly. In our operations, the orientation is a 2-day affair, and then there's the training. Training after that, there's the medical, the pulmonary tests, all this other stuff. So it's quite expensive to hire someone, and doing a less than good job at it, of course, is a costly thing. And sometimes we can, and I've done this, our company has done this in the past, where a person's not really working out and you let it go, and you promote a person and it's not working out. This has happened, I don't want to exaggerate, but 10 times in my career at least, where you'll promote somebody beyond their level of competence and hope it works out. Well, it doesn't work out. It'll never work out. I think that's one time you can say the word never. It just doesn't work out. So it's just so important. I'm not involved in most of our company's hiring or any longer. But it's very, very, very important. And the one fellow who has spent quite a lot of time in human rights told me that you're better off to make no hire than a bad or wrong hire. Because of all those things you'll go through, you know, that ends up a waste of time and money and effort. So you're better off not hiring until you find the person that you really think is the right one for the job.
I think that's good advice.
Wanted to get that off my chest, Jim.
I'm glad you did. Tell us a little bit more about your adventures with Dr. Wilson Greatbat.
Yeah, he was quite the impressive man. My goodness, that must be 30, maybe a little more than 30 years ago. I'm sure he's passed away long before now.
He has. I looked it up.
He was an elderly gentleman then. I was so impressed. His operation, his physical plant, if you will, was like a park. There were deer running around. There were some acres. There was deer running around, and it was just beautiful. He invented, I think I told you, the pacemaker, the heart pacemaker.
That's right.
And then he invented the lithium ion battery to run the pacemaker. And he had the first process to not really recycle those batteries, but to deactivate them so they were no longer reactive and dangerous. And obviously a brilliant man. And I think what I was most impressed about, he wasn't in the fancy office and plant buildings. Dr. Greatbat worked in an old house. He might have lived there, Jim. I don't know. It was maybe his home, but a very old two-story house, solid brick house. And that was his laboratory, you know, and his workspace. And what a, you know, some of these geniuses are a little eccentric as well. But he, you know, what he accomplished was really something when you think about it. The pacemaker and that battery too. You'd hate to have them open up your chest twice a year to change the battery. So it was brilliant. The lithium ion coin cell, they're little, like a 10 cent piece, the lithium battery that he invented. That's about, I visited his works twice, met Dr. Greatbat the one time, and, just a true scientist, Jim. True scientist he was.
And how did that lead to your work?
Well, I was in the throes of wanting to copy his very primitive lithium battery deactivating process. It was quite simple, explosion-proof room, of course, and even the hammer mill was made of steel that busted the batteries apart. Because they, you know, every battery with an explosion, it's a lot cheaper to weld steel than it is a nickel alloy or any of the stainless metals. And it was a pretty cool setup. Then he had a fire. Almost everyone in the business has had a fire to do with lithium batteries. And now these MRF, these municipal garbage collection areas, transfer stations, we also call them, more and more are there fires caused by lithium batteries. And Dr. Greatbat's outfit also had a fire, and fire is usually in storage, Jim, where something will happen, water will get in, there'll be a breached battery or something like that, it's quite a fire. A lithium fire is really something. With an amount that you can put on your pinky finger, much smaller than the top of your pinky finger. I told you that we had a fire with pure lithium metal, light as styrofoam too. It's very, very light in weight, and a speck the size of a lead in a pencil. Got out of the small granulator, dropped on the floor, and one of the the worker's drop of sweat is what ignited it. By the time we got it out, it had burned through a 13-inch thick cement floor right to the earth, about 6 feet in diameter. So we were discussing this on the last show, the dangers, and I for one wish they'd come up with an alternative to lithium for some of these energy sources. And I don't know how many people know that lithium is a reactive metal, and my goodness, if you think water is going to put it out, it's worse than gasoline on a fire.
And why did you think that you should start a lithium recycling? Obviously, you were getting a lot of it out of the ships.
No, it wasn't out of the ships. It was out of our battery company's public collections. We had 5,200 collection sites in the province of Ontario, and we received batteries from six or seven different countries, including the United States.
Go back in time at the very beginning. Talk about how you got into it yourself. Why were you thinking this was a smart idea?
Well, it was from these collections where we got primarily the alkaline batteries. That's the process that we invented in-house. That's currently the best demonstrated technology in the world for the alkalines, the non-rechargeables. But when you do these public collections, Jim, you get all types. Lithium, nickel metal hydride, nickel cadmium, mercury, lead. You get all they have the small consumer batteries in just about all the chemistries now. So it's made it a more challenging job as we went along. There are literally thousands of batteries from the D size on down to the small coin cells, tiny coin cells even. And we have to, our plant had to sort them and then process them ourselves or ship them off to an approved processor of that chemistry. For example, we never processed nickel cadmium. We didn't have a process. We were actually in the throes of doing that, putting in a process. And what happens with the nickel cadmium is they're heated up in like an oven. The cadmium has a very low melt temperature, so it's fumed off and then recondensed into cadmium sold in sticks and balls. Literally like a drumstick and a round ball the size of a pool table ball or snooker ball. And then what you're left with is the nickel scrap that has been decontaminated from that cadmium. Cadmium is the second most dangerous metal to human health. Mercury is first, lead is third. Lithium is just called a reactive metal because of it is reactive. The water moisture in the atmosphere is plenty of moisture to get a lithium fire going. So that's what makes them so reactive and dangerous. But our goal, and of course we didn't have the manufacturer's support. The big companies you think of that sell batteries that you see on TV have done a big job demoting battery recycling, resisting it the world over. Europe does the most and they've been doing it the longest. But if you looked at the statistics for the whole world, it's pathetic that in 2024, maybe 2 or 3% of consumer batteries actually get recycled. We had it up to 54% in Ontario until they breached our contract, and in the end, we sold. We couldn't collect any more fees from them, so we sold that company's assets. And there's another company struggling with those guys now. But our next move was the primary lithium, just to deactivate, and then of course we would recover the metal jacket. That's just metal scrap, and metal can be remelted an infinite number of times. It doesn't matter what metal it is, in a furnace, copper, brass, aluminum, steel, stainless steel, every single metal is infinitely recyclable in a industrial furnace like that. Zinc, all of them. So we would have recycled the jacket, the case, and we'd have made lithium hydroxide with actually baking soda is the main ingredient, and water. Once the battery is deactivated, we're taking the black mass. You can make lithium hydroxide. You can make lithium carbonate, which is a little more expensive. The challenge today for these people that are trying to, they're getting the big contracts from General Motors and the like, and Tesla. Tesla just threw the towel in on their efforts to recycle lithium batteries, recycle them to the extent, Jim, that the lithium metal can be reused again as lithium metal in batteries. Heck of a challenge. Tesla just gave up on that. There were 15,000 people laid off, including our former chief engineer was laid off. Because they get very, very challenging to, if you understand what I mean, to recycle lithium from scrap batteries to an extent and quality that it can be used again in new batteries. So I really don't know of the one company, you know, announced here in Canada, oh, it must be 5 years ago now, you know, process lithium ion batteries, vehicle batteries, EV electric vehicle, they call it, batteries, which are just small cells hooked together in series. And they went to the stock market to raise $600 million. They raised $1 billion, and they're in trouble right now without a final process. It's a very, very complex process to build. When we went through the science ourselves, and we had just an incredible PhD engineer that was on our staff, an older gentleman, he's passed away now. It was going to cost over $160 million just to build the recycling part of it, not to have quality of lithium that could be used in new batteries again. But just to recycle it, recover it, and deactivate the batteries and recover the lithium, but not in a form that they could use again for batteries. So it's quite an undertaking. I don't know. I'm no scientist, Jim, and I keep thinking that at some point, you know, we're going to think that this was maybe a wrong turn. They're making and starting to make green hydrogen. Of course, wind power, solar power, they're doing more offshore now with the wind power, these giant wind turbines. The trouble is it takes one heck of a lot of them to replace the fossil fuels that we've been burning in our cars and trains and planes and ships and heating our homes and so forth. It's a heck of a thing to replace that quantity. And, of course, the costs, as we all are beginning to experience, but the costs are going to be way up. I think that the regardless, with all these various alternative energy sources, I think the cost of electricity in our homes or at somebody's workplace or a steel mill, electric furnace steel mill, it's a serious issue for them, that's for sure. I think at the end of the day, the cost of electricity in the next 6-7 years will be triple. So, you know, if your bill at home was $100, you might expect $300. So it's quite a change that we're going through here. And of course, we have good incentive to do it. But I think we started a little bit late, Jim. And it's not going to be cheap, of course.
Wayne, we are about out of time. Very interesting. And I'm glad you got that off your chest. And I got a couple more details about the lithium and excited to continue to learn more next time. Thanks for being with us.
All right, Jim. Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. We are out of time, but we are back tomorrow. Be safe, everyone. Take care. Bye now.